Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Antoine Blondeau to the broadcast. Antoine is the co-founder and chief executive officer of Sentient Technologies, the highest-funded artificial intelligence startup in the world. Antoine has worked at a number of technology companies, including Nortel, Salesforce.com, and Good Technology. He also has previously served as the CEO of Dejima, the company involved with the DARPA project that later evolved into Apple's personal assistant, Siri. Antoine received his MBA from the Paris Graduate School of Management. I recently caught up with Antoine as he was traveling on business to Hong Kong, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as we discussed the war for talent in Silicon Valley, Principle 2, Infrastructure, as we discussed the balance between security and innovation in the artificial intelligence domain. We also discussed his strategic planning process, his plans to use the large amount of venture capital investment that Sentient Technologies has attracted, the state of artificial intelligence today, the balance between artificial intelligence advancement and artificial intelligence safety, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Antoine, thank you so much for taking time this afternoon. It's a pleasure to meet you, and I've been looking forward to our conversation.
So do I.
Excellent.
Go ahead. What can I help you with?
I just wanted to have a conversation with you about Sentient Technologies, obviously, about AI more generally speaking. Keen to speak with you and get your perspectives as somebody who's been a practitioner for so long in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think it's the space has become crowded and a bit, and the messages have been coming from a lot of places. But in fact, what's interesting is we started this company what 8 years ago now, and we've been involved in AI and machine learning for I would say 15, 16 years. The team that is behind this company has been involved in that for 15, 16 years now. So to us, this is nothing new. Although of course for a lot of people out there, it has become a topic. For us, it's been something we've been working on for the past 15 years. So it feels that we've been preaching for it, but now that it's finally resonating.
Yes, and obviously part of what is helping it resonate now is a couple of different trends, like the emergence of relatively low cost and available computing power, and obviously just the vast abundance of data that companies in almost every industry are collecting about their products and services and customers and et cetera. And obviously now, thanks to companies like yourselves and others, there are ways to synthesize all of that information to create better insights and make better decisions. So this must be particularly exciting. I think I've heard you say, Antoine, that we're in the first inning or in the very early stages here, that so much innovation has yet to come, which is clearly the case. But I'd love, again, as somebody who's been in this for 15 years, I got into it, in fact, before some of those trends that I just described had fully blossomed, kind of where you see things now. And I'd love to actually, of course, use that by extension, start to get further into Sentient Technologies and your vision for the organization and so on. But I'd love your thoughts about how this is evolving and sort of where things stand currently.
Yeah, so I think you're right on the money when you talk about what's happened over the past 5-7 years that is really making this possible. When some of the team members and I worked on what the precursor to what became Siri, this is now more than 10 years ago, 15 years ago even. At the time, we were thinking of an algorithm running on on one machine, or maybe a few machines. And what's happened over the past few years is that you have the data you mentioned. It's broadly available. And one of the things we foresaw was that not only data would explode, but also the dimensionality of data would explode. So people would collect a lot of data, a lot of types of data, which they had not collected before. So that's a big help. The second thing is, as I just said, we've moved from thinking of the machine being the compute to the network being the compute, which means we can, for example, harness an enormous amount of compute cycles. In our case, we're running our system on up to 2 million CPU cores. And we also have a few thousand CPU cards. It's a massive system, when we started this company 7 years ago, we had the vision for, but could not quite imagine how we could get there. But I think now we can. And the last thing is, as when you begin to think in terms of this scale, you can begin to address problems that you had not thought were solvable previously. So the ambitious nature of what you do can go up significantly. So you can tackle dimensionality. You can tackle complex decision making. We have a concept called the OODA loop, which I'll come back to. But effectively, you're looking at comprehensively including every step of the decision making in a machine or in this giant network machine, which previously was really not something you could think of was possible. But that's the high level, and I'm happy to go into the specifics because I think that's where it becomes interesting.
Yeah, I'd love to dive a little bit further into the details of how this becomes reality and also how that has impacted the way in which you have thought about entering different markets. I've heard you speak about the applications, as others have, in some of the primary industries where there is a tremendous amount of data and where there are particularly big problems to solve, like financial services, like healthcare applications of various kinds. I was curious, I found it very interesting that one of your first areas to apply sentient technologies is actually in retail as well, and online shopping. And I'd love to understand further about how you've chosen where to focus and dive a bit further into the details as you described.
So one of the things we did was building a powerful platform. But you know, you never succeed by building a platform. You need to apply it to know that A, it's working, B, it scales to multiple industries. So we decided to prioritize it to address trading, to address aspects of the e-commerce or the online content discovery experience, as well as at the research level, we've worked with institutions like MIT and University of Toronto, as well as Oxford, to work on maybe less monetizable or less immediately monetizable problems, but you know, world problems nonetheless. And I'm talking here about genomics and you know, taking care of patients in an ICU context. In each case, the common denominator is two things. One is, can you try to solve a problem that has not been solved before? So the complexity of the decision-making process is key here. So we're ambitious, and I'll give you an example. And the second thing is, can you encapsulate the whole decision-making process within the machine? So let me give you an example. In e-commerce product, which was released more than a quarter ago, we're looking at effectively providing the user with a shopping assistant, just as if he or she would walk into a store and would be interacting with a real physical shopping assistant. And that involves that feedback loop from entering the shop virtually in this case to getting an instantly curated version of the catalog. That is something that in the real world takes a human a lot of processing to achieve. It is immediately in the moment understanding what the user's intent is and reacting very quickly to that, which means effectively understanding how in the moment the user is interested or looks at the array of of choices that he or she sees in the shop. And we're taking that paradigm and putting it back into the online world, which means in our case, we're building this giant dynamic, I will use the word matrix, but don't think science fiction when I say that, this giant dynamic matrix of the shop's inventory. So if you look at a shop that may have 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 pairs of shoes in its catalog, it's virtually impossible for you, the user, to discover in a meaningful way. You can do a selective discovery, perhaps, by browsing through rows and rows of images, but effectively, you're going to very quickly either get lost and go away, or you're going to make a suboptimal choice. What we're saying is that there's no reason why this catalog cannot behave as a shopping assistant would, which means being, you know, intelligently respond to how you browse it, how you walk through it. So if you click on image that describes a particular shoe, for example, this is very meaningful. It means you're interested in it. What is that you're interested in? Well, it might be something that, you know, you or I would be able to describe in meaningful words, like the color, the texture, or maybe a particular shape. Or it might be something about subtle that even you or I would not be able to describe, but for that particular user is very meaningful. And we say the picture is worth 1,000 words. Well, that's what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to show you articles, items that are relevant to you, that will mean a lot to you, just like a shopping assistant would in real life, because he or she understands your intent.
That's powerful. And obviously there's a line that can be drawn between some of the early work that you and colleagues were doing in the precursor to Siri and some of the things that you're describing now of using technology to create a better experience and in some ways replicate the experience that one would need from an advisor of some sort or an interlocutor, a human interlocutor anyway, and using technology as the new interface. I'm curious, as you think about that personal assistant, that person with whom you are having really kind of like a conversation, how do you map that out? How do you contemplate what qualifies as good advice and think about the process that a human will likely go through and then map that out such that you can then leverage the data to parse through the various decision points or different factors that a human might go through in order to reach a conclusion to this sort of an experience?
You use the right word, you use the conversation, and that's exactly the right word, because in a conversation, you actually get instant feedback. So when you and I are having a conversation, you and I may not need to know what we did yesterday or what we're interested in. Might help, but very quickly, as you know, two fellow humans, we can go into a meaningful conversation, not knowing each other very well to start with, just because we're able to relate. And there's no reason why an AI would not be able to do the same. So in this case, primary feedback loop, which is that interaction, that conversation, is the way that the system becomes more intelligent and more relevant to you. So that conversation in this case is, oh, you clicked on this image, but you didn't click on that one, and the last click was this. And that means you probably are interested in this, but we're going to also show you optionality. So give you the opportunity to lateral think across these other things. So we're going to effectively do what the shopping assistant would do in real life, which is react to your intent. Oh, you know what? I like this shoe here, but not this one. And then I'm going to present you with something, and you're going to say, well, forget about this. What I really like is this. And that discourse actually is extremely useful, because in real life, first of all, you don't go through 20 iterations. You typically go through 4, 5, 6 before you get something you like. And similarly, you can achieve the same thing, but on a much larger catalog very, very quickly with the system.
Your organization is currently the most well-funded AI company. Congratulations on that. I'm curious, how do you plan on using this sort of war chest, for lack of better terminology, the funds that you've been able to raise? Where do you see emphasizing your own investment? Obviously, a big part of what is necessary
is scale, and you have almost an unprecedented scale from at least within the private sector. There are a number of great organizations that are being built that might be targets of acquisition to fill out your portfolio as you think about the offering that you put together. What are some of the ways in which you see leveraging some of the resources that you've been able to put together?
So in several ways, but number one, clearly we're building into verticals which we've chosen as our go-to-market. So e-commerce and online content is one, and trading and financial services is two. So we're building into that, which means we're investing, hiring, building sales and marketing organizations to address the opportunity in those. In addition, we are indeed actually selectively looking at acquisitions to bolster our presence in those two things, because there are great people out there. And if you look at great people and great technologies out there that can complement our portfolio, if you look at what we do very well, we do scaled AI very well, which implies that we have a lot of technology, deep technology in AI itself, and we invent the science there, but we also scale those technologies to the hilt, which means we have to innovate around the scaling. So our core competence are highly scalable systems and deep AI. But what we don't have necessarily is the domain expertise. And so we learn the domain expertise, which means we have to onboard it by hiring people. We have to acquire it. So that's how the money is used. Then the next opportunity beyond this is to build the path to our third and fourth verticals over time. And we're beginning to do this so that by next year and the year after, we begin to apply our AI to more, and that will take also additional capital.
As this is a very hot space right now within technology, and you operate a company in perhaps the epicenter of technology in the globe, in Silicon Valley, there's an extraordinary war for talent right now. And people who have the combination of skills are not necessarily in long supply at the moment. How do you think about the acquisition of talent and keeping it in a place where there are so many opportunities for the very people who you would want to hire?
So you're right. The war for talent is very much on. There's no way around it but to have and build a strong brand in the space. And to work on exciting problems. So, you know, why do people come and work with us? Well, because first of all, they know us. You know, we got out of stealth mode a year and a quarter ago. The primary reason we did that was because we had a need to scale the company. We doubled in size over the past 12 months. We're gonna increase again by a factor of 50% at least this year. So that requires you to have a brand so that you can compete visibility-wise in the marketplace. Second, we really work on stuff that's really attractive, that's really different, that's ambitious, and people, when come in, can make a difference quickly. So what engineers are really interested in is, of course, they're interested in being successful, and so are we. But at the end of the day, they're interested in trying to solve problems that have not been solved before and sexy stuff. And that's what we really offer to these guys. So not only do they come, But they also stay. We have virtually no turnover in the company. That's because effectively we're giving people the opportunity of working and solving problems that they haven't solved elsewhere. And it's very hard. So who competes against us when it comes to talent? Big firms, Facebook, Google, Apple, people like this. And I think those are great companies. But will they give you the same opportunity to leverage yourself and maximize your potential? Probably less. That's the opportunity here. So we have this unique opportunity of having scale like these firms, is having the organization of a startup. I think the combination of both is interesting.
That's interesting. And you mentioned that the difficulty and the challenge of the problem is something that's particularly attractive to the sorts of people that you are bringing on board. As you mentioned a short while ago, you've been in this for 15 years or so. You worked in the technology that became Siri. As you mentioned, when you got involved, the dynamics were not what they are today, and therefore one might argue that the path towards success in AI wasn't as clear as it is today. So you certainly chose a domain that had a great set of challenges. I can only imagine that you feel a kindred relationship with the very people that you're bringing on board because you've been tackling tough problems for some time. What drew you initially into the AI space, especially, as I say, at a time when perhaps less so than today, was it obvious that it was something that, as to the certainty of its applications, or at least how quickly factors would come together to allow it to be revealed in full blossom?
You know, when I started in the space, what I found very interesting when we were working on this foundational technology that became Siri, eventually, what I found very interesting is that those are the days when Google was emerging. And at the time, we thought of it as one dimension problem where you were effectively searching. And or rather, the world was thinking of it as one dimension. And we thought of it as, okay, can we begin to look at this as a multi-dimension problem where you need context, you need to observe more of the world, you need to build orientation and abstraction. So I think this was this very early discovery that, you know, maybe search is just one aspect of it and you can do more. But it was very fuzzy at the time. And it was very forward-looking and probably a way too forward-looking. But what was interesting is pretty quickly you could actually get to a demonstrable proof of value. So when you could begin to interact through natural language with online services, that was compelling. At the time, it might not have been monetizable, but it was compelling experience-wise. What changed in the middle of the last decade was that suddenly, business model came through. So you could begin to monetize anything that was online. And I think as I looked at the next iteration of this, and when I started this company 8 years ago, that I knew that the difference was that we had graduated from a cool technology where we can establish proof of value or proof of concept to an opportunity not only to build great technology, but also businesses around it. And that was the major change that occurred, I think, 7, 8 years ago, that certainly 15 years ago wasn't present.
I'm also curious, there's a big debate, which you're well aware of, between the advances, the very rapid advances that are being made in AI and, for lack of better terminology, safety related to the same topic. And I wonder how you think about the balance between those two.
So I believe, like I think everyone in the industry, that we as practitioners have a duty to invest in a technology and push the boundaries and understand where it can go and head. But also we conversely have an obligation to understand what it can do that would be damaging to society. So I think fairly uniquely in the space of technology generally, I think the industry has early on gathered to take a step towards self-regulating, so to speak. I mean, it's a bit of a strong word because there's no real regulation in place, but there is an understanding, a common understanding of, hey, maybe we'd better look at ourselves and look at what we do before governments intervene. Not that we don't like governments, but simply because we think that governments are always a bit slow. And so let's make sure that we behave as an organization or as an industry. We signed a pledge. So my chief scientist, my institute, and myself, we signed a pledge with the Future of Life Institute a couple of years ago. And we're going to continue to invest time in doing that because we think it's relevant. But with that said, like every single piece of technology, you can use it for good, you can use it for bad. I don't think for the life of me that anybody today is working on applying AI to areas where would pose a threat to society. So it's not that I know or that I believe that people are working on this, but it's important for us to take an early stand towards directing the use of this to the right use cases. So we're doing this. We're going to do more of it, as always. But again, it's like any type of technology before, whether it's back 1,000 years ago or back 50 years ago, you can use it for good or for bad. Just use the world to use it for good.
As somebody, again, who's been in artificial intelligence for some time, I can only imagine that the way you see the world is a little bit different from a lot of other people, in as much as you probably are going through your daily life and contemplating what aspects of it could be enhanced by technology, or how you can replicate, as we've already described in a couple of the examples, human interactions where technology could play, you know, a role that approximates the value of that interaction or that transaction. I'd be curious how you apply some of what you've learned from being a practitioner of AI back into your personal life in these ways or in others.
Yeah, so you're right. You know, effectively, you can think of a lot of, perhaps every decision we make or abstraction we make that could be replicated by a machine or a very large scale network of machines. So we have this concept of the inner loop, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's essentially observe, orient, decide, and act. And that's a concept that was invented by a U.S. Air Force colonel in the 60s and 70s, where he was looking at dogfights. And he realized that a lot of the winners were the folks who had gone through that feedback loop of fighting dogfights often, but eventually were the very best at winning dogfights. Not necessarily the best pilots, but the ones who had the most experience effectively and had gone through that feedback loop. And I think when we build technology, we build technology to address each and every step of these. So orient, so observe is perception. Orient is abstraction. So you orient and develop concepts against the context. Decide, obviously, you act. And then decide to make a decision and act. You act upon, and then that comes back into the feedback loop. So every single thing that we do every day can be technically, and maybe technologically in this case, automated. So it makes me think often about whether what we're doing or what I'm doing is optimal daily. But more importantly, it makes me think about things that I otherwise couldn't solve. So for example, you know, maybe it's not all that very useful that I have, I mean, you know, that I have a robot that's going to pick up my groceries. You know, I still need to walk and exercise my my muscles. So I don't mind going to the supermarket to or take my car and go there. I don't really mind this, but maybe it would be extremely useful if the shop was reacting to me in real time and was able to deliver the right things to me right now, and I would not waste time within the place to find what I want. Maybe the cart would be ready. So the walk is what I still want to do, because I'm human, but I'd rather not waste my time on, you know, picking between 20 different brands of this, or deciding whether I need, you know, that article today, or maybe I would only need it in 1 week. That is maybe the worst, the better use of my time. And so I think of it as augmenting human intelligence, that we can focus on the productive stuff. We can really begin to make decisions that matter to the world, as opposed to be buried in the minutiae every day. And hopefully, if we can achieve that, I think we create a much more interesting, much more rewarding world. Of course, that doesn't happen overnight. But if we do make this, I think what we have seen over the past 100 years, 150 years, will be nothing as compared to what we're going to see in the next 30 to 50 years.
I wanted to close with, I certainly won't ask you to pontificate where we'll be in 30 or 50 years, but how long out is your strategic plan as you're thinking about the future and thinking about developments for the organization? And I have to imagine, of course, that there's a great deal of flexibility in what you create, just given the need to pivot and react and seize opportunity and so forth. But say in a year or two or three, depending upon how far out you care to offer comments, where do you see the organization going? And as I say, I'd love to understand kind of how you think about that strategic planning process, the window you give yourself as you think to the future.
So we're building technology for 10 years or more, but we're thinking in terms of 3 to 5 years when it comes to going to market. So let me try to explain what that means. You know, effectively, the scale at which we're building and the ability to scale this further is fundamental to what we do, which means we can really think 10 years out and see, okay, what type of problems could we solve in 10 years' time? What kind of dimensions, how abstract can we go? What complexity of problems could we try to tackle in 10 years? I think going beyond 10 years becomes very speculative. But 10 years is a technologically is a realistic time horizon. Product-wise, however, and business-wise, you cannot build 10 years out, especially in the startup world. You have to build 3 to 5 maximum. And so what we're doing is we've decided to invest in our two verticals. We've decided to operate in another 1 to 3 within the next 3 to 5 years. So effectively, over the next 5 years, we're building a company that will operate 3 to 5 verticals and will attempt at being a dominant player or a leading player in these, which means we will, you know, you always say in Silicon Valley, eat your own dog food, but that's really what it is here. We will exercise our ability to build a real a set of businesses across 3 to 5 verticals in a way that has never been done before, in a very scalable AI-driven way, and proving this way that you can build AI, full-blown AI businesses. And as you do that, then you prove the value of the platform, and eventually you might then offer that platform to others. Not today, not in 3 years, maybe in 5 years, but you are able to offer that platform as a tool set for others to build their own or solve their own problems using it. So that's how I see the company. So we're technology driven and technology based, certainly deep technology based company, but we're product. We are a product firm, another platform firm, and we're building to deliver products. Then eventually, as we prove that you can build businesses, offer this as a platform, and then who knows what happens in 10 years.
You are European, so you're French, you were born, raised, educated in Europe. You obviously, for some time now, you've been not only in the U.S., but also in Silicon Valley. Why did you elect to pursue your career there as opposed to a place like Paris, for instance?
So, well, there's something very unique about the U.S. generally and Silicon Valley particularly, and that's you are able to take risks and be trusted with that ability and be supported to pursue a risky but trailblazing path. That is very unique. And, you know, this thing about Silicon Valley called creative destruction, I really believe in that. There is a massive amount of creation, a massive amount of destruction. But coming back to this feedback loop, that destruction comes back to learnings. Learnings comes back to building something better the next time around. And that happens all the time. And it's very, very powerful. Together with this, I think the critical mass now, I think, is hard to overlook. But I think, frankly, the first is the biggest thing. Europe has a lot to offer in terms of skill sets, education, but it still needs to offer its people the ability to take risks, fail when you cannot succeed, but fail once so that you can succeed the next time, fail twice when you can succeed the next time. And that's what I think Europe is missing. I think it's got a base to develop it. I think we need to invest in that.
Antoine, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I really do appreciate you being so generous with your time and with your insights. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, absolutely, Peter.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' 5 principles of World Class IT. The 5 principles are as follows. Principle 1 is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.